Chapter 3 Mishuk Gotalu Mishurak Pako Kiore. Pressure makes gems, ease makes decay. Mandalorian Proverb. Slave 1, en route to Bador, Kuat System. Myrta Gev had settled for being tolerated by her grandfather, and although she made an effort to love him, it was hard. Part of her still wanted to make him pay for the life her mother and grandmother had endured, and part saw a man who had every form of regard shown him except love, and pitied him. Overall, she saw a man who put up Durakrete barriers and defied anyone to breach them. As he took the fire spray out of Mandalore's orbit and prepared to jump to hyperspace, his expression was set in apparent blank disdain for the everyday world. She decided his helmet presented the softer face of the two. At least she got to sit in the co-pilot's seat. That seemed to be the nearest that Boba Fett could ever get to approving of her as his own flesh and blood.
"Your clone's not an active bounty hunter," said Fett.
There was never any preamble in his conversations, no small talk, no intimacy. He was all business.
"I checked every bounty hunter and wannabe on the books, but none is called Skirata. Plenty of people on Mandalore knew Cal Skirata, and then gone, vanished."
"But he was on a hunt. I know that. He told me to get out of his way."
Did Fett believe her? She'd stitched him up and tried to lure him to his death, so she could hardly blame him if he was having second thoughts about the clone. The man was real, all right.
"So we are retracing his steps?"
"Yours."
"How are you going to pass yourself off as a client looking to hire a bounty hunter?"
"I'm not. You are."
Myrta suddenly realized why he'd agreed to let her ride along.
"My, I do come in handy, don't I?"
"Earn your keep. Rules of any partnership."
Myrta thought that sounded remarkably like her dead mother. Aelin Vell was more a chip from the granite block of Fett than she'd ever admit. But that was impossible. She'd been a baby when Fett had left her grandmother, too young to pick up his callous ways.
"How do you cope?"
Myrta asked.
"What?"
"How do you cope with being alone?"
"Are you going to yap all the way to Kuat?"
"You can't bring yourself to tell me to shut up, can you?"
"I cope because I like it that way," Fett said.
"Well, Mama was all I had, and I don't like it that way."
Fett paused, and there was the faintest movement of his lips, as if he was stopping himself from saying something he'd regret. He ought to have understood, she thought. He'd lost his father at the hands of a Jedi, too.
"Yeah," he said. "What about your dad?"
"He died in a hull breach, not even in combat."
"Why'd Aelin marry a Mondo? Sintas must have warned her we're bad news."
Myrta found she was clutching the Heart of Fire pendant tight in her fist. It was just half of the original stone. The other slice, split from it with a blow from the butt of Fett's blaster, was buried with Aelin Vell in a modest grave outside Keldabe, in an ancient wood that the Vongese hadn't managed to destroy.
"I can't feel anything from this stone. It ought to tell me something. I'm Kiffar. Part Kiffar, anyway." "She hung around Mondo Ade to get a better idea of how to hunt you. Then she met Papa. It didn't last."
"Romantic."
"She cared about him."
"And she let him make a Mondo of you."
"I spent 2 summers with Papa on Null, after he and Mama split up. He taught me everything he could. And then he got killed."
She didn't say it to shut Fett up. He was hardly a talkative man anyway. But there was quiet, and then there was breath-holding silence. That was what she heard now.
"That's too bad," he said.
"Don't try to out-orphan me, Babuir. I know what it's like."
She struggled between the hatred she'd been taught to feel for him and the evidence of her own eyes that he wasn't a monster. At least, not the monster painted by her mother. The very thought felt disloyal to the dead. After almost 2 months, she'd reached the stage where she had days when her mother wasn't her first waking thought and didn't haunt her dreams. That felt like betrayal, too. But life had to go on. She had to make sense of this and not let Aelin Vell's death be for nothing.
"No need to discuss it, then,"
he inhaled. He looked like he'd been holding his breath all that time.
"Are you okay living where you are?"
"Yeah."
"I could buy you a house of your own. Anywhere."
Myrta never knew when he was going to flip over into awkward generosity. Bevin said he had his moments. He might, of course, have been trying to get rid of her with the lure of a place on a far planet.
"I'm okay where I am, thanks."
No, that sounded dismissive.
"I meant that I like living with Veivut's family."
Fett said nothing. She knew what he was thinking now.
"Yes, I do like Orade," she said. "He's a good man."
"You're a grown woman. None of my business."
But everyone knew she was a Fett now, and that carried with it some burdens. It took a brave man to risk a Mandalore for a grandfather-in-law, especially one with Boba Fett's reputation. Myrta shut her eyes and tried to listen for whispered messages from the Heart of Fire.
"Why can't you get information from that?"
Fett asked suddenly.
"I'm only part Kiphar. I don't have the full ability to sense things from objects."
She opened her eyes again. Fett was still an implacable statue of detachment. She studied his profile to see what of him might be in her.
"It's called psychometry. They say some Jedi can do it, too."
Mentioning Jedi might not have been a good idea, but Fett didn't show any reaction.
"The stone absorbs memories from the giver and receiver," he said. "Sintas said so."
Ah.
Under the veneer, there might have been a man who wanted to either relive happier times or hide the ones he preferred to forget. The stone held a little bit of Sintas Vell's spirit, and a little bit of his. There was more veneer to him now than core, Myrta suspected, but she'd seen him cry, and nobody else had ever seen the adult Boba Fett weaken. She was sure of that. Maybe he hadn't even cried as a kid.
"I'm trying hard, Babuir."
"Worst thing you did was tell me you knew what happened to Sintas."
It was a slap in the face. When she'd said it, she hadn't even known if it would do the trick and lead him into her mother's ambush. Now she regretted hurting a dying man, even if she had been raised to loathe him.
"We'll find out how Grandmama died. I promise."
"After I get that clone," Fett said, all gravel and calculation. "I'll find a full-blooded Kiphar to read the stone."
Myrta took it as a cue to shut up. Playing happy families wasn't the Fett way. She wondered how many other families had the record of violent death and attempted murder that theirs did.
"I hope what's in me is more like Papa."
Then she recalled Leia Solo deflecting her blaster shot at Fett and knew that it was Babuir's blood in her veins after all. Grandpapa's.
"Stand by," said Fett.
He didn't deploy full dampers when Slave One jumped. He never did. The acceleration to lightspeed and beyond felt like being punched in the chest and then sat on by a hut. She made a point of biting her lip discreetly as the stars streaked to lines of blue-white fire and the crushing sensation passed. That had to hurt him, too. He was a sick man. Myrta fumbled in her pocket, pulled out some painkiller capsules, and held them out to him. He took them without a word. His fingertips were cold. It felt like a long, silent lifetime to Kuati space. Myrta filled it with planning how she would disembowel Jason Solo if and when she got the chance. There was already a line forming for the privilege. Babuir wouldn't say what he had in mind for him. All she was certain of was that Boba Fett never turned his back on a score that required settling.
"Decelerating in half a standard hour," he said.
She wanted very badly to love him, but couldn't. If she had found out what happened between him and her grandmother, she might have found it easier. But she knew it might also have confirmed her legacy of revenge. One thing she'd learned fast was that it was a subject to avoid. It wasn't that she was afraid of asking. She just couldn't get past the silent routine. He could make the world outside vanish if he wanted to. Bador was a striking contrast to Mandalore. Slave One swept on a descent path past orbiters and over cities studded with straight roads and open plazas. Myrta checked her datapad to orient herself.
"What was your dad's name?"
Fett asked. "Makin Marek." Fett always had a reason for asking questions. Perhaps he was wondering who else he might be related to. They landed at one of the massive public ports in Bunar, and Fett went through his ritual of setting all the alarms, trip beams, and other lethal traps that would greet anyone stupid enough to try breaking into Slave One. He'd brought a small speeder bike in the hold, and he swung onto the seat a lot more easily than he had last time. The painkillers were strong enough to anesthetize a bantha.
"You're navigating," he said.
He bounced a little on the leather saddle, as if testing whether he could feel any pain.
"Get on."
Myrta patched her datapad into her helmet system.
"Head down that speeder lane and go south for 5 kilometers.
She was getting used to wearing a boucher. At first, it had seemed suffocating and disorienting, but weeks of being surrounded by people who relied on theirs had made her feel a misfit without one. The streaming data on the HUD now got her attention without distracting her. She hadn't fallen over anything for a while. And it made her feel Mondo. Her father would have approved, but she tried not to think what Mama would have said.
"I miss you, Mama. I miss you so much, and I never even said goodbye."
Fett's tattered cape slapped against her visor in the slipstream, jerking her out of her memories. And Myrta wondered if she'd eventually become like her grandfather, or like her mother. Bitter resentment about being robbed of a parent seemed to run in the family. Fett steered the speeder through increasingly seedy neighborhoods and canyons of high-rise warehouses and apartment houses. Bounty hunters tended not to ply their trade in the better parts of town. The number of shabby family homes decreased, and the scattering of unsavory characters loitering on corners and in speeders increased.
"So what were you after here?"
Fett asked.
"Recovering stolen data."
"You mean people around here can read?"
"No, I have clients who can. The locals steal anything even if they don't know what it is. I go and persuade them to hand it back."
"And your clone with the gray gloves was definitely here?"
"Yes."
After a couple of wrong turns, the cantina appeared right on cue. In daylight, it looked even worse than it had when she'd last visited. A peppering of blaster burns had left blisters in the paint on the doors.
and the masonry was pocked with holes from ballistic rounds that hadn't been there last time, as far as she could tell. A trail of blood drops from the door ended in a larger pool, dried to a dull, tarry blackness. Street cleaning wasn't frequent here. A sign above the door said, "Welcome to the Paradise Cantina." It also said, "No helmets."
"I'm offended that they don't respect cultural diversity," Fett muttered.
"That's how I know what the clone in gray looked like. He took his helmet off."
"Fine."
A couple of low-life males, a human and a Rhodian, ambled to within 10 meters of the speeder and stared at it. Then they seemed to notice Fett, and then his blaster and rocket-loaded backpack, and suddenly they appeared to remember pressing business elsewhere. Fett locked the speeder and set the anti-theft device with a thermal detonator. The two males broke into a run in the opposite direction and vanished.
"They don't seem to know me here anyway. Fame's fleeting."
Myrta took off her helmet. Fett ignored the request above the doors. The bar smelled as bad as it ever had, a mix of vomit, stale ale, and oil that could have been from machines or very old fried food. The clientele matched their environment, possibly because they'd spent their disposable income on state-of-the-art weaponry. The Kuwati barkeeper was filling small dishes on the countertop with pickles that bore an unappetizing resemblance to eyeballs. So they stood at the bar trying to look normal. Normal for the paradise, anyway. The barkeep caught sight of Myrta first. She must have been staring at the pickles too carefully.
"You got to buy a drink," he said. "No snacks without."
Then his gaze swiveled. The helmet got his attention the way a chest plate alone didn't.
"Oh, you got the nerve to come in here, have you? You mondo slag!"
He ducked below the counter for a split second, and that meant only one thing. Myrta wasn't sure if she had her blaster level before Babuir did, but when the man straightened up with a highly illegal short-barreled 10-loss disruptor that could have reduced them both to ground nerf, he was looking down the muzzles of Fett's sawn-off EE-3 and her Blast-Tech 515. It startled the barkeep long enough for Fett to land a left hook straight in his face. He fell back against the glasses stacked behind him, and a couple smashed on the tiles. Fett caught the disruptor as it clattered onto the counter. Myrta instinctively covered his back, but none of the customers moved. She was starting to feel comfortable doing this double act. The sense of camaraderie, a long way short of family bond, had crept up on her. Fett examined the disruptor and jammed the safety catch on hard, one-handed.
"Remember, no disintegrations."
The bartender staggered upright, cupping one hand under his nose to catch the dripping blood.
"The last Mondo who came in here wrecked this place. You're all the criffing same, and I don't want you in here, so why don't you—"
Myrta realized she must have missed some fun and games after she'd left the gray clone to his hunting.
"That was a long-lost relative," she said. "We're looking for him."
"Well, when you have your family reunion, I want him to pay for the damage from last time."
The man didn't seem to recognize Babuir. But then Fett wouldn't have taken a contract from this low down the food chain. Senators, crime lords, and the wealthy who could afford him knew his armor. Barkeeps tended not to.
"Time we shared some reminiscences about my wayward kin," said Fett,
tapping his forefinger impatiently against the trigger guard of his blaster.
"I'm not as careful as him. My name's Fett."
The barkeeper's face drained of what blood there was left in it. Myrta actually watched his color change to a pasty gray. She'd never seen physical fear like that before. The man's eyes scanned Fett's visor, and the revelation was almost comic.
"It was a while ago,"
Mandalorian in gray armor with gray gloves, called Skirata.
If the bartender was expecting some credits to be slapped on the counter to jog his memory, Fett wasn't playing.
What do you know?
Okay. He killed a guy here. Lot of damage. Lot of attention from security, too.
The barkeeper stared at Myrta now, and he was evidently piecing things together.
Yeah. You were with him, weren't you?
Not for long,
said Myrta. She'd moved out of the clone's way fast. Into a different cantina, in fact.
Who did he kill?
Gang boss called Cherit. It made the local holo news even.
Obviously, most shootouts here didn't warrant a headline. Myrta made a mental note to check the archives.
What do you know about Cherit that didn't make the news?
Nothing.
I realize a blow to the face can affect your memory.
Fett still hadn't lowered his blaster.
Try again.
Okay. Cherit's outfit supplied Rak, Luxatalic, and Twi'lek girls to some minor Kuati knobs. He was doing his deals here for a while. Maybe he was muscling in on your relative's turf.
Doesn't sound like our line of work.
Fett stood facing the man for a long, long time. The barkeeper looked like he was grasping for something else to say to fill the silence. Eventually, Fett leaned his blaster against his shoulder, muzzle up in the safety position, and seemed appeased.
If you see him again, tell him little Boba wants to see him about a job.
How's he going to get in touch with you?
Mandalore. Right turn off the Hidian Way. Can't miss it.
Okay.
And where does Cherit's gang hang out now?
The barkeeper turned to the shelves behind him and fumbled frantically in a pile of flimsy sheets.
Don't tell Frigg I gave you this.
It was a napkin embossed with a logo that said, The Tekshar Falls Casino.
You'll find Frigg there most afternoons, at the Sabacc tables. Kuat City. Frigg took over from Cherit.
Fett pocketed the napkin and strode out. Myrta followed him, backing through the doors more from habit than fear of attack.
You reckon Frigg paid the clone for a change of management?
She said, scrambling astride the speeder behind him.
That's what I'm thinking.
If he did, he'll know how to find him.
The speeder bike swooped over the rougher parts of Bunar and headed back to Slave One.
Do you play Sabacc?
Fett asked. Myrta knew without asking that her grandfather wasn't a recreational gambler.
No.
Plan B, then.
What plan B?
I'll tell you when I've worked it out.
What was plan A?
Dress you up nice, send you in to play a hand or two, and wheedle something out of Frigg.
Thanks.
It'd never have worked anyway. You're not the wheedling type.
It might have been an insult or a compliment, but she had no way of knowing with Fett.
I want to like him. He's not likable, but he's not what you told me he was either, Mama. How could you even know?
Myrta found herself arguing with a dead woman, hating herself for it, and finding that nothing she thought she knew was solid any longer. She took one hand off the speeder's grab bar and eased the heart of fire from under her chest plate to grasp it. Maybe it would tell her something sooner or later.
Great painkillers,
said Fett. She could see the dried blood on the knuckles of his left glove as he flexed his fist. The stain was bothering him.
Thanks.
There was the faintest tinge of warmth in his voice. It was a start. Jason Solo's office, GAGHQ, Coruscant. There was a voice in Jason's head, and he never knew whose it was. At times it was clearly Vergere, clearly a memory, but at others he wasn't sure if it was his own thoughts or Lumia's suggestions surfacing from his subconscious, or something else altogether. There were times when he even thought it was his conscience. It was his conscience now, he was sure of it. All he could see was his daughter, Alana. "So you're not thinking about Tenel Ka, then?" Whatever act he had to perform to become a full Sith Lord, it would be extreme. It had to be harder than killing a fellow Jedi, harder even than herding Corellians into camps, or turning on his own parents and sister, or subverting democracy. It had to be the most painful decision he'd ever taken. "I just can't kill my little girl." "Who says I have to? What would that prove?" "That you'd do anything to acquire the powers to bring peace and order to the galaxy." It was Alana's future that had made him start down this path. Now it would be a secure future for everyone's kid except his own. "That's what it's about, Jason. Service. Painful service. Embrace that pain." No, it wasn't service. It was insane. He wouldn't do it. But was it any different from sending your own children to war, making the same sacrifice as millions of other parents? Wasn't it always harder to give a loved one's life than your own? No. The only sacrifice worth making is your own life. But Lumia said he'd know. She said he'd know what he had to do when the time came, and she couldn't tell him. He'd been with Tenel Ka and Alana since then. He'd felt nothing, no hint from the Force that this was the final step, that these were the people he had to kill. "Maybe this is denial, delusion. It's not Alana. It's not even Tenel Ka." "It's not them," he said. "It has to be Ben." And then he was back in his office, horribly aware, looking up at a bewildered Corporal LeCalf. There was a cup of caff on the desk in front of him, and he hadn't seen anyone put it there. He'd never been that distracted before. It scared him. He couldn't afford another lapse like that.
"Lieutenant Skywalker hasn't reported for duty yet, sir."
LeCalf, grandson of the officer who had faithfully served Lord Vader, had a scrubbed, freckled cheerfulness that prevented him from looking menacing, even in black GAG armor with a BT-25 blaster.
"Can I help?"
Jason felt his face burn. "Apologies, Corporal. I was thinking aloud."
"That's okay, sir. I thought you were doing some of that Jedi stuff. Communing."
Jason had to think for a moment. "Melding?"
"That's the stuff."
"I think I need more calf before I try that today. Thank you."
"Did you get Admiral Neofel's message about Kit, sir?"
"What's that?" Jason checked his datapad and assorted comlinks. Bureaucracy didn't come easily to him. He'd make sure he had the best administrators when he... "When I what?" "When I rule as a Sith Lord." The idea was 90% sobering, 9% inappropriately exciting, and 1% repellent. If he could have identified the source of the revulsion, a distaste for power, an old Jedi taboo, plain ignorance, he would have listened to it. But the voice wasn't loud enough. It was his small fears, his reluctance to accept responsibility, and that was something he had to ignore.
"She says some of the frontline units are having problems getting the kit they need," LeCalf said. "Annoying stuff. specialist ordnance, comm parts, but some seriously non-negotiable items like medical supplies, too. They're also complaining that the cannon maintenance packs aren't up to standard, and they've had some malfunctions.
LeCauf raised his eyebrows.
We're starting to find problems acquiring what we need, too, sir.
That got Jason's attention.
This is the richest and most technically advanced planet in the galaxy, and we can't keep our forces adequately supplied in a war?
LeCauf gave Jason a significant nod that directed him to his holoscreen.
I think the Admiral put it a little more emphatically, but that's her general reaction as well.
Is there a reason for this?
Procurement and supply seem to be dragging their feet, sir.
Time I undragged them,
Jason said. He hit the comm key and opened the line to procurement.
I'm sure it's fixable.
If you'd like me to talk to them, sir.
I think they need a full colonel to motivate them, LeCauf. But I'm grateful for your offer.
Jason suddenly felt it was the most pressing task on his list. He and Neothel expected a lot from the armed forces, and it wasn't too much to expect the military bureaucracy to back them up.
I'll get things moving. Find Captain Chevu for me, will you?
He's out on surveillance, sir. Intercepted some nasty ordnance, so he's out with Sergeant Weirit watching a drop-off point.
Chevu was hands-on. He didn't seem to be as enthusiastic about the GAG's role as he had been a few weeks earlier, but he did his job and led from the front. There was nothing more Jason could ask of an officer.
Okay. I'll catch up with him when he's relieved.
Procurement frustrated Jason from the start. When he got an answer from the comm, his status as commander of the GAG didn't seem to open as many doors as it did in the rest of the Alliance. By the time he was put through to a senior civil servant in Fleet Supply, a woman called Gellis, he wasn't impressed, and his calf was cold.
"We can't bypass the supply system, sir," said Gellis. "All requests are dealt with in sequence."
"Shouldn't they be dealt with by urgency, as in front line?"
"I don't have the power to do that under the procurement regulations, sir."
"Who do I talk to about quality of supplies?"
"Which supplies? You see, we have four item departments."
"Cannon maintenance packs. We're getting complaints about poor quality replacement parts."
"That would be engineering support. They have their own system. You'll have to—"
Jason had learned patience and a dozen ways to calm his mind in crisis from as many esoteric force-using schools. He didn't want to use any of them. He wanted to lose his temper. He wanted action.
"There's a war on," he said quietly. "All I want is for the right kit to get to the people fighting. What's the fastest way to do that?"
"You're not Fleet, are you, sir? GAG is domestic."
"Meaning?"
"This isn't your chain of command. We'd need authorization from a senior officer from Fleet to pursue this request. It's the regulations, sir."
"But I'm commander of the Galactic Alliance Guard. I don't even have this much trouble getting to see Chief Omis."
The apparently limited scope of his authority galled him. He could call on star destroyers and entire armies, but getting past a bureaucrat was impossible.
"Would the Supreme Commander's word do?"
Gellis swallowed audibly.
"Yes, sir."
"Then I'll come back with that."
Jason closed the link, furious.
Rules.
He wasn't used to these arbitrary limits. If he couldn't get simple supply issues ironed out, then his future as a Sith Lord looked limited. His rational mind told him this was an annoyance that could be solved with a message to Neothel and a little delegation to a junior officer. But another sense entirely told him he had to stick with this.
Good for morale, he thought.
No, it was something else. He couldn't put his finger on it. Rules and regulations. He scrolled through the comm codes for the Alliance Defense Departments and found legal and legislative. He tapped the sequence, and a human voice answered.
Can I borrow a legal analyst droid?
He asked the assistant. Jason preferred his legal advice from the most dispassionate and unimaginatively honest sources. A droid could grind through the small print in the statutes for him.
Right away, sir.
That was more like it. Jason's mood improved. In the meantime, he still needed that simple authorization from Admiral Neothel to get the kit moving.
Good officer. Good tactician. Hidebound attitudes.
But he needed her as much as she needed him. LeCouf returned with fresh calf. He should have been off duty, according to the roster.
You're too busy to do routine administration, sir, he said. Are you sure I can't take it off your hands?
I'm sure, said Jason. Procurement and I need to get a few things straight between us.
LeCouf grinned.
You show him, sir.
Something told Jason that it was more important to show him than he could ever imagine. And that voice, he listened to it.
The Skywalker's apartment, Coruscant. Luke looked at his hands, right, then left. One was prosthetic, and one was flesh, and had been touched by someone he was beginning to think of as his nemesis. Lumia. In the middle of a battle, he'd had the chance to kill her, and they'd ended up touching hands in a gesture that between normal people might have been considered reconciliation. I said I didn't want to kill her. Luke Skywalker had never wanted to kill anyone. Sometimes it happened, though. He stood up and took the Shoto out of his belt, the short lightsaber that he felt he needed to deal with Lumia and her light whip. What's happening? What does she want? She'd never been one to play mind games like Vergere. She was a soldier, a pilot, an intelligence agent, a fighter. He'd yet to put the pieces together, but she was connected to Jason's slide into darkness in some way. Luke made a few idle practice passes with the Shoto and tried to visualize what might happen if he ran into Lumia again. Then he wondered what he'd have done at 19, and he knew he wouldn't have thought about it too much. He wanted things to be that clear again. The doors to the apartment opened, and he heard Mara and Ben talking. Relief flooded him. He laid the Shoto on the table, and every rehearsed line of warning and disapproval vanished, replaced by a simple need to grab his only son and crush him in a hug. Ben stood rooted to the spot and submitted to it. Mara gave Luke a warning with a raised eyebrow, but he wasn't planning to scold Ben.
I'm glad you're safe, Luke said. But if anything I did made you go off like that, we need to talk about it.
Ben looked at Mara as if seeking a cue to explain.
I was working. I was on a mission, that's all.
Jason, you liar. You said he resented the fact that I stopped him being your apprentice. Only Jason could send him on a mission.
Luke considered casually asking Ben who'd sent him, but he knew anyway, and he didn't want to descend to tricking his own son into giving him information or putting him on the spot about Jason. He didn't need any more proof that his nephew wasn't going to turn back to the light without some substantial help. It was help that Han and Leia couldn't give. It was beyond the Jedi Council, too. This was family trouble. He'd sort it out, with or without Mara.
Comlink silence? He asked.
Yes, Dad. Sorry.
Ben might have been surprised by the hug, but he hadn't recoiled either.
I can't discuss it. You understand, don't you?
Of course I do, son. And I bet I know who told you not to. I really hoped you weren't going to stay in the GAG.
I'm good at that kind of work.
I know.
I can't ever be a good little Academy Jedi now, Dad. I have to see this through. We've had this argument before, haven't we?
Ben's tone was regretful, not a whiny teenager's protest about his parents' unfairness. It was sobering to see him growing up so fast. Growing up? No. Aging.
There's a war going on. And once you've served, you know you can't walk away from it and sit it out while your friends risk their lives.
Luke.
Mara's tone was reproachful, with that slightly nasal edge that said she wanted Luke to stop.
Is this really the time for all that?
He ignored her. I understand, Ben. I do. But the GAG isn't the place you should be.
Isn't it?
It's not the way the government should deal with dissent.
Then that's why I should stay in,
Ben said quietly.
If it's a bad organization, then it needs good people to stay in it and change it from the inside, and not abandon it to the bad guys. And if it's a good organization, then all you're really upset about is my safety, and I can handle that better than you think. You wanted me to be a Jedi. I'm being a Jedi.
Ben's logic and moral reasoning were impeccable. You have a point.
So am I a good person, Dad? Or do you think I've gone bad, like you think the GAG has?
It was a question Luke had never wanted to consider. What was a bad person? Most people who did evil things were neither good nor bad, just fallible mortals. The only truly irredeemable being he'd ever known was Palpatine. And presumably even Palpatine had once been a little boy, never dreaming he would be responsible for the deaths of billions and savoring his power. Luke realized he wasn't sure he knew what a good person was when he saw one, or at which point they turned bad. He was painfully aware of Mara's gaze boring into him, green and icy like a river frozen in its flood. You're a good person, Ben. Is he doing anything I didn't? You think about what you do.
Thanks. And I'm not leaving the GAG, Dad. You'll have to make me, either physically or through the courts, and none of us wants that. Leave me where I can do some good.
Fights could be had without raised voices or angry words. Ben had fought and given his parents an ultimatum. Luke knew he would have to tackle this another way. And blast it, Ben was actually right. The GAG couldn't be abandoned to the bully boys. Just look out for Lumia, Luke said. You told him, Mara?
I told him.
So are you going to stay for something to eat, son? He asked, feeling Mara's gaze thaw a little.
I'd like that,
said Ben, 14 going on 40. It was hard to have a family conversation over a meal without mentioning the war. Ben wanted to know how Han and Leia were doing. Mara shunted vegetables around her plate as if trying to sweep them under a carpet.
Things aren't too good between Jason and your aunt and uncle at the moment, sweetheart, she said. But whatever he tells you, they still care about him and want him to be okay.
It's not personal, Ben said. Hey, I tried to arrest Uncle Han because it was my job. I didn't mean him any harm.
Luke thought about Jason's haste to abandon his parents during the attack on the resort satellite. He couldn't see Ben doing the same thing. If he could, he didn't want to see it.
Dad, was the Empire really a reign of terror?
Just a bit.
I know you and Uncle Han and Aunt Leia had a rough time of it, but what about ordinary people?
Mara chewed with slow deliberation, her gaze in slight defocus on a point in the mid-distance.
You might want to ask Alderaan. No, wait. It's gone, isn't it? Oops. That's what happened to ordinary people. and I know better than most.
Because you did some of it. Luke faced up to the fact that he couldn't expect Ben to believe a word either of them said to him. They'd both done things that they were telling him he couldn't do now.
But most people didn't really notice, did they?
Ben seemed to be fixed on course.
Their lives went on as before. Maybe a few people who were political got a midnight visit from a few Stormies, but most folks got on with their lives. Right?
Right, Mara conceded. But living in fear isn't living at all.
It's better than dead.
You think the Empire was okay, Ben? Luke asked.
I don't know. It just seems that a handful of people can think they have the duty, the right, to change things for everybody else. It's a big decision, rebellion, isn't it? But most decisions that affect trillions of beings get made by a few people.
Luke and Mara looked at each other discreetly, and then at Ben. He'd acquired political curiosity somewhere along the line. Whatever mission Jason had sent him on, and he had, Luke was certain, it had made the boy think. Or maybe Luke was just losing touch with the fact that his kid was a young man now, and changing fast. When he left, though, Mara still helped him on with his jacket. Luke almost expected her to ask him if he was brushing his teeth every day, but being Mara, she did her maternal fretting in more pragmatic ways, and pressed a matte gray object into Ben's hand.
"Humor me," she said, and kissed his forehead. "Carry this. You never know."
Ben stared into his palm.
"Wow!
That," she said, "was the best vibroblade the Empire could buy. It saved me more than once. A lightsaber is great, but a lightsaber and a vibroblade is even better."
"Plus a blaster," Ben said.
He grinned.
"That's better still. The triple whammy."
"That's my boy."
After Ben had left, Mara cleared the plates.
"When did we produce a communally minded political analyst?
Too many Gorog buddies, maybe."
"Does that look like an out-of-control, screwed-up boy to you?"
"No," Luke said. "But it's not Jason's influence that's making a man of him, even if he's the only one who seems to be able to handle Ben."
"Luke, we still have to do something."
"Oh, now we have to do something? What happened to leave him with Jason? He's good for the boy." Luke almost had to bite his lip to avoid saying that he'd told her so, which he'd always thought was the mark of someone who wasn't looking for a solution to the problem, just points to score. "Besides, he doesn't seem to be getting corrupted by what's happening. Maybe he is that good man on the inside. Maybe you were right to make me let our kid join the secret police."
"I meant about Lumia."
Mara had a way of bracing her shoulders that said she knew she'd made a big mistake, but he didn't have to rub her nose in it.
"Okay, I've changed my mind. Jason's gone bad. My fault we've wasted a few months placating Ben. Satisfied? Now what about the root cause of this?"
"We haven't picked up her trail again."
"And then what happens when we do?"
Mara smacked the plates down on the counter so hard they rattled.
"What are you going to do? Hold her hand again?"
He should never have told her that Lumia had offered him her hand when they were fighting. It was eating away at her.
"Because the poor old girl doesn't mean any harm. Lumia? Queen of the Stanging Sith?"
There really was no ill intent in her. Mara rolled her eyes.
"Of course there wasn't. She doesn't want to kill you. She wants to kill our son."
She grabbed Luke's face in both hands and made him look into her eyes.
"Luke, you could have killed her. Cut her in two, finished the job. But you didn't."
Luke felt inexplicably ashamed. "I couldn't."
"I know.
We come from different schools of justice, don't we?
Sweetheart, she's not your father, Luke. There's nothing good left in her to redeem. She's a threat that needs to be taken out, and that's what I'm trained to do, and you're not. Forget this take-her-alive-if-possible garbage. The only way anyone's taking her is dead.
Luke had had a feeling Mara might say that. He knew when she was building up to something. She might have thought she could keep things from him, but he knew her well enough by now to see the cogs grinding and the plan forming. He'd missed his chance with Lumia. He wouldn't get another.
You're telling me you're going after her?
You might tag along if you could be trusted not to go soft on her.
Mara let him go and looked embarrassed. Her cheeks were flushed.
You can have Alima. She needs a serious attitude readjustment with a lightsaber, too. It's not as if we haven't got enough kill-crazy stalkers to go around.
No matter what happened, Luke knew he didn't have that assassin's ability to kill someone who wasn't trying to kill him right there and then. If he had... So Ben wasn't the only one navigating a moral maze. Luke had been doing it for decades, but the maze was only acquiring more twists and turns each year.
"Let's see how much Jason perks up with Lumia gone," he said.
Wait, did I just bless an assassination?
And with Alima out of the way, then Leia and Han can come back into the fold, and we can face this war as a family again.
Mara patted his cheek with a regretful smile and set a droid on cleaning the dishes. She spent the rest of the afternoon assembling and checking an array of weapons that definitely didn't come from a civilized age.
"I never knew you had one of those," he said, pointing to a blaster that had the wide-mouthed muzzle of a grenade launcher. "How are you planning to use it?"
"With a flechette cartridge. Let's see her try a light whip on that."
"Do you want to take my Shoto?"
"You offering?"
"Good luck token, maybe?"
"Under the rib cage token, more like. Unless that's all Durasteel, too."
This was his wife. Sometimes he caught a glimpse of the woman she once had been, and she was a stranger for a second or two.
"How are you going to track her? She hides very well."
"I can hunt very well."
Mara took the Shoto hilt and spun it like a blade.
"A little bait, a little investigation, and a little force help."
She ignited the energy beam.
"Plus, if Alima is trailing after her, as seems to be the case, then one of them is going to slip up and show herself."
"Lumia doesn't slip up."
"Well, she's not running the galaxy right now, so I guess she does sometimes."
Mara spun the Shoto in the air and caught it by the hilt as it fell.
"And she keeps showing up lately, so I'll be ready."
"Just keep me informed where you are, okay?"
"You'll know."
Mara gave him her best I-know-what-I'm-doing grin.
"And who better to go after a former emperor's hand than another one?"
"You did that before..."
"And that was before I had a son to worry about."
The grin faded.
"I'm much more dangerous now I have a cub to protect."
Luke had no doubt about that. But it was the first time in his life that he regretted not killing someone when he'd had the chance.